Session number 20456, reel 26.
Brigadier Wilson, reel 26. Because of this conflict over territory between the Greeks and the Turks, and the other conflicts between them, did this lead to complications in planning the exercise? Did the exercise planners take account of the differences?
No, not at that level. This is much more on a diplomatic level, really.
Did the Greek and Turkish military officers in shape, did they get on with each other on a personal basis?
Yes.
Do you remember if it was reckoned the Russians might attempt any sort of offensive action in that area?
I can't remember it being considered.
You mentioned you had a visit to Marshal Tito, who you found impressive.
Yes.
And you also mentioned that Montgomery was sent to visit the Pope. Did you go with him on that occasion?
Yes. But I did not attend the actual meeting.
You weren't at the audience.
When one went for an audience, I didn't attend the private meeting with Tito, but I was there at lunch, where the discussion went on. You see, the Italian visit was always a strange one, because he also used to visit the Vicar General of the Jesuits.
Yes.
Again, on his own.
Yeah.
All of us who had anything to do with that suspected that he was carrying not so much messages, but ideas. Two people like Tito, who he saw, acting as a bit of liaison, I'm sure it was.
It was personal diplomacy.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly.
Have you any idea what he wanted to discuss with the Pope or with the Vicar General?
Oh, I think the whole business of Christian relations across the board, and the tensions between the Christian and Orthodox churches and communism.
Did you go on any other high-level missions of that sort? Where you were
well, I mean, Salazar of Portugal, I went and saw.
What sort of fellow was he? Did you get an impression of him?
He was the sort of person you would expect to be a state governor, smartly dressed, extremely well spoken. Again, at that time, Portuguese were having problems with African colonies. And I think that, I was present. I know that they talked about the whole business of withdrawing from that sort of situation, how the British had done it, and so on.
But Salazar was discussing that, possibilities of withdrawal or...
Salazar,
are you saying that Salazar discussed the possibility of withdrawal from the
colonial mechanics, territory? Not the possibility of the mechanics. Yes. I mean, they were off. They knew very well that their time in Portugal, West Africa, was finished. Question was how.
Well, they didn't withdraw until, I think, the 1970s, did they? The early 70s.
Eventually. There was quite a certain amount of shooting.
Yes. Yeah. Was Salazar, do you think, expecting assistance from NATO or from Britain?
No.
Now, of course, Spain and Portugal, again, were both nominally neutral at that stage. Were they regarded as being friendly neutrals who might...
Oh, Lord, yes. I mean, you see, you go... Portugal is ridiculous. You go past a Portuguese barracks and what you hear, British bugle calls.
Yes.
You have to pinch yourself a bit. Mm. And they're doing British drill, don't they? Relics of the peninsula.
Were there any major issues that came up during the time you were at SHAPE that you remember having to be decided?
No. There were no great excitements. Well, yes, I suppose the whole business of De Gaulle taking over when, you know, the Parachute Army of North Africa was supposed to be descending on Paris. And,
yes, Colonel Massu and his friends.
Massu, yes. And it didn't happen.
Did that bring about any change in the French policy or outlook or behaviour, De Gaulle's takeover?
Well, in the country then, I don't think so. Basically speaking, the ordinary Frenchman wanted, you know, to have nothing to do with Algeria. It was your French army and French civil service who'd after all served out there that were disappointed that things had turned out the way they had.
You were saying that Montgomery was responsible for thinking about the future, and presumably the main vehicle for that was this three-day exercise once a year. And his other area of interest was training.
Was?
Training. Training.
Yes.
Yes. What was he doing about training? Was he trying to introduce some kind of consistent policy for NATO as a whole in the field of military training?
I don't think that's quite what he was trying to do. What he was trying to do was to get the higher commands thinking along like lines. In other words, if you thought, if you've got the same object in mind, your training would be modified to carry that out.
I mean, one of the great differences between the British Army and the American Army and Continental Armies is that they tend to have doctrine and always have had doctrine, whereas at that time we didn't. We still had principles of war as a basis for thinking about operations.
Well, yes, but you see, people will tell you that nowadays, certainly in 3 or 4 years back, the British Army was gradually slipping into doctrine.
It has adopted it officially.
Yeah.
But in those days, it didn't. So, and it sounds as though, from what you were saying, Montgomery was trying to produce some sort of consistency or harmonisation.
Well, he was, yes. I mean, so that we get on with each other. You see, I mean, you had rows about weapons.
Yes.
The calibers of weapons.
Yes.
There was a row between us and the Americans about the 7.62 bullet.
Yes.
There were equal rows about guided missiles. And the thing was that you had American arms production, British arms production, and coming up, of course, French very much so in the air line, and the Germans recovering themselves again. And obviously, economically for each country, the more of their own kit they flogged aboard or to other nations, the better off they were. And so you had this sort of always niggling on what sort of machines, what sort of weapons we wanted.
Did Montgomery have a view of this idea of doctrine? Did he believe in the British principles, or did he lean towards the idea that doctrine might be useful?
That one. You see, his big thing was simplifying things. He said all sorts of problems, you've got to simplify the problem. But there are some problems that can't be simplified. It's no good bashing your head against a brick wall and saying that, you know, this is a simple answer, this is what we must do, when there are economic factors involved. His ideas were on a far higher strategic level than that. But I mean, when it came down to quarrels about calibers of bullets and things, and he would get hold and say, look, we're going to say, what is the best bullet, you know, we've got? We surely must know that. Surely, around that, you then design the best rifle, or the most useful rifle.
It sounds as though he didn't really fully understand the political power of arms manufacturers to lobby governments.
Right. I think you're right. I think when it came to politics, he could be very naive. As regarding, you see, the book he wrote about his history of war, where he criticised Ike. Well, it was a frightful row, and they never spoke to each other again.
Well, he was always very critical of Eisenhower, wasn't he?
Well, he was, yes, but in this case, he was more. And I mean, I remember reading, he gave me a draft chapter read, and I said, sir, I don't think you should put this one in. And he said, but it's the truth. And I said, well, it may be the truth, but what good is it going to do, you know? I'm sorry, and he said, I'm sorry, I won't compromise, you know. I write the truth as I see it. So he was, a politician will bend, he wouldn't.
Now, round about the time you were with Montgomery, we were embarking on some adventures in the Eastern Mediterranean. In 1958, we were engaged in operations in Jordan, and the Americans went into
Lebanon.
Indeed,
when the King of Iraq got murdered and so on.
Exactly, yes, in the aftermath of the Iraqi Revolution. Do you remember that having any sort of effect?
Well, no, but you see, it was out of the NATO area.
Yes.
I think he was saddened by it, yes.
This is Montgomery?
Yes. But I mean, now you do.
No. I mean, did he express any view of what the British and French, the British and Americans were doing in the Levant at that time?
No, yeah. Not that I remember. I think what the significance, as far as I was concerned, was that he trained me and my sort of brain to organise my life. In some ways, quite differently.
In what ways differently?
Well, to really sort of think before you acted. I mean, and to be able to, I mean, you attended these meetings with him. No notebook, no pencil. But that evening, you had to produce in your own longhand a complete account of what went on. And when I first heard I had to do this, I said, I don't believe it, you see. And Danny Esmond White, my predecessor, said, yes, but you see, what you have got is you will know exactly what he is thinking, what his line of thought is. All you have to remember is what the answer is. And therefore, you know, it'll hang together because you have been so drilled. You've got so inside his mind that it became almost natural, yeah.
How long did it take you to pick up that? Because it's a particular mental
skill. I suppose about 4 months.
So was it tolerant of you being deficient in the early stages while you were learning how to do this?
Oh, yes. But, I mean, he didn't mind you making mistakes. What he could not stand is doing something stupid, you know, which he reckoned you should have got right the first time.
How would he react if you made a mistake and owned up to it? Would he?
Well, he would sort of say, well, put it right, you know, no problem. You admitted it, no problem. You were completely trusted.
Besides that skill of thinking at the higher strategic level and being able to absorb ideas and retain them and reproduce them, did he teach you anything else?
I suppose you would say he thought me to think. yes, I think he did. Mm. He certainly taught me one thing, because one was able, one picked up the skill of being able to read through papers very quickly indeed, and being able to summarise them, you know, quite shortly.
Praising.
Yes. Yes.
How long would it take him to read a document of, say, 10 or a dozen pages of an appreciation of a staff paper?
It would say, not very long. All I used to get was a summary.
Yes.
You know, I mean, a vast American sort of tome would come in.
Yes.
And attached to the front would be sort of 2 pages, you know. As I see it, this is what this is recommending, you know.
Would he go through the tome, or would he just look at the summary and basis?
No, I mean, talking about that was his summary.
Oh, I see. Yeah, so he would have read the whole thing and reduced
yes.
it. Yes.
Yes. He was a marvellous reducer of verbosity as a fact.
How did he relax? You said he would go home sometimes and relax, or he'd relax at the weekend. What did he like to do to unwind?
He read quite a lot. He walked a lot. Out in the countryside. You see, he was a good cricketer in his day. Didn't play any cricket then. If you really ask me, I don't know that he did relax all that much. He didn't enjoy cocktail parties. They talk about the rest of the time. Nice sit down to nice dinner or something. That's great, and talk. He loved what you might call serious discussion. Yes.
Were there any particular topics that attracted him?
Oh, you name them, he would talk about them.
So he had a broad interest rather than a.
Oh, anything. Not necessarily army. No.
What about his reading? Was that broad, or did he focus on particular subjects?
It's pretty broad, actually. Mm.
Did he like reading fiction, or was it mainly non-fiction?
I think it was non-fiction, really. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. He was not an easy... He was in some ways rather a prickly person to live with. Mm. I mean, he was a marvellous host. If you had lunch, if you had a sewer lunch and all this, it's great fun. But he never you felt that there was always a mask of apartheid, as it were.
A mask of
well,
apartheid.
I think because after his wife died, you know, he in some ways cut a bit of his life off. He wouldn't... I mean, his relationship with his son David was very strange.
How was that? What's strange about it?
Well, first of all, when he was abroad, David had to be looked after by us, the foster family. Then, after years of this, when he came back home, well, he would scarcely have anything to do with this foster family. You know, the most extraordinary business. And then he, when David married and then got divorced from this girl, Monty cut him out of his will. It was all put right in the end, but he wouldn't speak to his mother at the end. They were a dagger's drawn from when he was very young.
Do you know why that was? Did he
oh, she was a disciplinarian.
Yes.
She used to beat him. Child abuse, I don't know. I mean, at one particular occasion, there was some ceremony. And I had it in writing him, make sure that Lady Montgomery does not come.
You were put in charge of keeping his
one had to sort of liaise with the various political authorities. Yeah.
Was he a religious man, do you think?
Yes. Of a Cromwellian type of religion.
That sounds rather grim and austere.
The Lord mighty in battle, Oh, yes, he was. And he believed very strongly in that. There's no question about that.
Did he attend church regularly while he was at Shape?
Yes, sort of. Yes, yes. He wasn't sort of overtly religious, and he had to be seen attending church. But he'd go.
In August 1965, you were sent to Berlin as.
I think it was actually before August. I think before it was August. About June.
June. To Bricksmith.
Yes.
Yes. Had you had any previous contact or knowledge of Bricksmith before you went?
Nothing. I didn't know what it was.
What was it? What did you discover it was when you got there?
It was a joint Army RAF organisation for getting information as to what was happening to the Russian armed forces in East Germany. Our territory was East Germany.
What was it supposed to be formally?
The what?
What was its formal role and function?
What was it
formal? What was its formal role and function? What was it supposed to do officially?
Ah. You have to go back to the Robertson-Wallin Agreement of 1946, when, as you can imagine, the whole of Europe was in chaos. And it was a question of getting hold of refugees, prisoners of war, property that belonged to the various nationals. And General Robertson, who was then, I think, commanding Rhine Army, got hold of General Malinin, who was then commanding the group of forces in Germany, and said, look, how about us exchanging missions with communications to help in this job? And so it was agreed that we and the Russians would exchange a mission of approximately 31 people.
That sounds like liaison, wasn't it? Exactly. In theory, what you were supposed to be doing.
Exactly. In the meantime, the French and then the Americans also thought of a good idea, too. So you had the British mission, the American mission, and the French mission, and each with their equivalent Russian.
Yes.
In their own zones. And from time to time, and each was commanded by a two-star general. And each had their own communications. After a year or so, people began to realize that apart from resettling families and dealing with property and currency exchange and so on, a very, very great deal of information was coming back about what the Russians were doing. And so, little by little, we set ourselves up as, I'm trying to remember, covert. In other words, we were wearing uniform spies.
You were an overt.
We were in our own cars with a national flag in it. And a series of rules got drawn up as to what one might and might not do. We were not technically allowed, except at towns and hotels, to wander around the countryside outside our cars. We were not allowed to take photographs. We were not allowed to approach and talk to Russian soldiers. Well, all those, little by little, went by the board. And eventually we used to go out on tour with very, very, very sophisticated camera, and later on, not TV, what you call the thing?
Video.
Yeah, equipment, and so on. And the amount of intelligence that we produced over the years was out of this world. The RAF did it a different way. They used to sit on the flypaths of run airfields and photograph some machines taking off and landing with, again, very high-power cameras. Unknown to us, we had listening devices all over Germany, who could monitor the transmissions. And so you got, they could tie it up with the photographs that the boy is taking. You've got a very, very, very good idea of operational procedures of the Russian Air Force. And a very good idea of their armament, all sorts of things.
I think you said that there were 31 in the mission. Was this combined Air Force and Army?
Yes.
What proportion?
I had my deputy was a group captain, Royal Air Force.
Yes.
I had, five Air Force officers, about 10 Army officers, and the rest were very high grade sergeants, corporals, and drivers who drove the cars.
Did you go out then singly? Did the officers go out just with a driver, with an NCO driver?
No. We were lucky because we were the biggest mission.
Yes.
And the chief of Bricksmith was sort of, ipso facto, the chief of all three missions in some
ways.
No, you had your driver. Mm. You had your NCO was a tour clerk. Mm. He had the maps, and he was, if you could describe it, sort of like going and shooting a stag on a Scottish mountain. The driver was a pony boy, as it were. The tour clerk was a guinea, and you were the rifle. You were the guy armed with the camera. Mm. Now, you would say to the tour clerk, I want to get to so-and-so, you know, where I am sure something, some skullduggery or other is going on. And it was his job to get you in there, through jungle tracks and things, and get you out. You never went into a place you couldn't get out of. You then took the pictures. In some cases, tour clerks did, but no, it was the officer's job. You were in charge of the tour. And it could last 24 hours. It could last longer. We had rations. We had specially modified Opel Capitans with long-range tanks and all sorts of interesting little things.
A four-wheel drive?
Oh, yes.
Could they go cross-country if necessary?
No, they were very good. They were marvellous. And then they produced a Geländewagen, but the Geländewagen was a big car. The Opels looked like an almost civilian car, but there you go. They were lovely machines. You were briefed as to what you had to do and the targets you had to cover. And when you came back to the American mission, where they had a big office room, and you debriefed yourself.